And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour Top 10. With Dean Haglund and Phil Lernis.
Wow. I think what Dean Haglund was trying to say was Happy Easter, everybody, wherever you spent it. However you celebrated it, we hope that your spirit has risen. And certainly mine has risen because we've got a fantastic show, a show I've been looking forward to for so long. You've heard me talk about it until I was blue in the face. It's a top 10 show. It's our top 10 mystery films, Dean Haglund.
Hooray! My favorite.
Is it your favorite? Now, we'll start with that before we leap right in. Is your feelings about the mystery genre? I've dominated about my feelings, if we can even call it a genre. But you are iconically someone who explored mysteries in your alter ego of Langley, one of the lone gunmen. And
well, that's true.
So I am curious. Prior to that, did you have an affinity for mystery films?
Well, you know, I had to really wrap my head around not having all the answers provided for me. So at first, I would be frustrated by certain mysteries in that I couldn't answer or solve them. So the anxiety level that these narratives provided, at first I didn't realize was the point. It was more, oh my God, this is way too stressful to watch. And often I would turn them off before the solution. So not realizing that if you watch it all the way to the end, it actually was very fulfilling, and that anxiety released with the aha moment. So so that took a while in my development as a young man, as a child, to really grasp the entire point of watching a mystery.
I'm going to start, if you don't mind, with a three-way tie for 10th place.
Wow.
Three films that I want to discuss. I'm cheating like crazy all over this list, by the way, Dean. If I don't discuss 16 films today, I will be shocked. but I want to do this because I think the starting point of mysteries for me, because before I loved movies, I loved reading. And
right,
the drawing room or the country house mystery, as it's been called, think often the Agatha Christie classic, probably on mm-hmm. screen. The best version of her works is probably And Then There Were None. But, you know, this mm-hmm. idea of all the suspects are together at the end and
right.
the detective or the detective figure, right? The detective stand-in
right.
in the case of And Then There Were None is there to figure out and explain the solution to everyone. So that's the starting point to me. And I have three films that embody this element, and they also bring certain archetypal elements to bear. The first is The Thin Man. It's a 1934 American pre-code comedy mystery directed by W.S. Van Dyke. And you'll find these descriptions, like mystery is apparently the movie, the genre you never want to call your movie. You call it anything other than that. And I wonder if
right.
that's because there's this belief that once you get the solution, why would you want to watch it again? You know who did it. But
exactly.
But what I find
However,
fascinating is the movies that I want to watch again and again and again are so often mysteries. And
right.
And one of them is The Thin Man, and it is because, as you were saying, you know, the release of the tension through the solution. Another way you release the tension so delightfully is through comedy, right? And
In Thin Man has that in spades. William Powell, so hilarious.
And Myrna Loy, so charming.
And Myrna Loy.
What a forward-thinking female role. Yes, she's, you know, she doesn't have her own job. She is a product of the time. But as a woman, she's very forward-thinking in terms of you know, how she expresses herself. And again, it's pre-code, so they could get away with that. He's a hard-drinking, retired private detective. She's a wealthy heiress, and they kind of get into sleuthing as a lark. but that first film, so funny, and the mystery itself is crackerjack in its construction, and it ends with an iconic black tie dinner party scene, all the suspects gathered around a table, and William Powell is going to reveal who did it. One thing to keep
in a massive monologue too, if I recall,
which is iconic, right? The massive monologue. And and one thing to note, he is not the Thin Man. The Thin Man references partway through the film Wynant, another character, as a thin man with white hair. But the Thin Man moniker became so iconic that by the later films, it is referring to William Powell's character. But you mentioned that the lengthy monologue, and nowhere is that more deliciously on display than in 1974's Murder on the Orient Express.
Wow.
Sidney Lumet's adaptation of Agatha Christie. I watched this again in the wake of, you know, the remake, and obviously this is superior to the remake in every way. They do a fine job constructing the mystery. I wouldn't call it necessarily a great film, but there is so much joy at having the biggest, highest-paid movie stars in the world all required to sit there in the end, silent, while the youngest and least famous among them, Albert Finney, unrecognizable, holds court. I mean, don't you love?
I'll give you that.
We're paying Lauren Bacall, Ingrid Bergman, Sean Connery, John Gielgud, Vanessa Redgrave, Michael York, Jacqueline Bisset, Anthony Perkins, Wendy Hiller. We're paying them all tons of money to shut up.
Right.
And
the problem I have with Orient Express, well, you say it's a three-way tie.
It's a three-way tie. And then the third that I have, and the reason it's a three-way tie is I think that if you combine these three films, you get so much of what is iconic as the foundation of the mystery form. But you also get a wonderful sense of humor about what is hackneyed about that foundation from its very origins. And so therefore, to really counteract all that is, let's say, not wrong, but again, artificial, limited, hackneyed about A Murder on the Orient Express, I give you 1976's Murder by Death.
Ah, you're kidding.
With every bit the equal cast to Murder on the Orient Express. You've got Eileen Brennan. Yeah. You've got James Coco, Peter Falk, Alec Guinness, Elsa Lanchester, David Niven, Peter Sellers, Maggie Smith, Estelle Winwood, written by Neil Simon, directed by Robert Moore. This is a movie that parodies all the classic detectives of literature, from The Thin Man and Dashiell Hammett to Sam Spade, to Hercule Poirot. They're all in there.
Charlie Chan,
played by Peter Sellers, or Sidney Wang, as it's known in the movie. But it is a broad parody and spoof of the country house whodunit, and it gets all the targets so right, while also giving really rich comedic characters for so many of this exemplary cast to explore and have fun with. So anyway, that to me is kind of a perfect rainy hangover Sunday afternoon, one that I probably did altogether too often, those three films, back to back to back. Those are my number 10.
That's your number 10. Good Lord. Well, see, so now my criteria, having said what I like about mystery, also that then embracing that tension, I like it when maybe it's not so clean cut, not so pat and dry, not so, and therefore this guy did it. And so, well, where does that leave me? So my number 10 is Usual Suspects. Here's a mystery of who is Kaiser Soze. And at the end, there's an argument that you can have afterwards that it's not fully explained which one of the characters is Kaiser Soze. Is it Kevin Spacey? Is it the guy picking up Kevin Spacey? Is it none of the unseen guy? This is the afterwards movie chat over coffee that could go on infinitum, and I think has since the movie came out.
Well, we've talked about this before, I think, but how at the first screening of the finished film, Gabriel Byrne almost beat up Bryan Singer in the parking lot. You know, saying, you son of a bitch, you said it was me.
Right,
and I played it as if it was me. And then it turns out it's not. I will point out that there is ultimately a the one witness who survives create an artist's rendering of Kaiser Soze. And that gives you a pretty clear answer at the end who it is.
But I have
a mystery that I'm going to hit you with that we'll discuss later when I bring up The Usual Suspects, and that is the bigger mystery of why would The Usual Suspects, so early in their careers, be what I think you can safely call Kevin Spacey's greatest performance, and why would it be the one great film that Bryan Singer had in him to make? What about The Usual Suspects brought greatness out of those two men in particular? And I will address that mystery later on in the show.
Say, look forward to that. Okay. You're number 9.
Well, I like that you brought up The Usual Suspects because also I love, as you know, true ensemble movies. And that will become a theme. You know, there's no way around this, that all of these movies we're discussing in some way influence The Lady Killers. And and The Lady Killers embodies a lot of what I love about movies. And ensembles are so important for and casting ensembles, not just ensembles
casting
in terms of writing them, but how you direct them and casting them. You don't want to throw the ensemble out of whack. And The Usual Suspects is a great one for not tipping its hand in any way through casting. And that's a real challenge.
Yes, for sure.
Now, a wonderful ensemble with often a lead who is a detective figure is de rigueur, and one of the most colorful ensemble casts, and a movie I don't think we've ever spoken about, but I'd be curious if you're a fan of it, is one of my two that are tied for number 9, and that is the 1986 Italian-French-German adaptation by director Jean-Jacques Annaud of the book The Name of the Rose, written by Umberto Eco.
Oh, yeah.
Now,
The Name of the Rose.
I'd be interested if you were a fan in this, because there is so much that screams Dean Haglund. The medieval period, the illuminated manuscripts at the heart of this mystery, this this concept of the church working in the shadows, not only through the Inquisition, which is depicted in the film, but to collect and hoard so much of the Earth's cultural inheritance in the form of rare manuscripts. And Sean Connery stars as the Franciscan friar William of Baskerville, really a delightful turn. The director, Jean-Jacques Annaud, did not want him, thought he brought too much baggage as James Bond, but they couldn't find anyone else. And his career, this is hard to imagine, was in such low ebb that Columbia Pictures drops out of the project because it's starring Sean Connery. But it really starts the turnaround for him. The next year, he would win the Oscar for The Untouchables. But that year, he won a BAFTA for Best Actor for The Name of the Rose for this medieval mystery, which introduces Christian Slater to the world. But as playing his sidekick, Agil. But the rest of this ensemble, F. Murray Abraham as the Inquisitor, the abbots played by Fyodor Chaliapin and William Hickey and Michael Lonsdale and Ron Perlman, these are some of the great faces to inhabit any film, but a mystery film? Oh, my God. You know, the story that their faces told. I find this film to be just great fun on all levels, as a period film, as a film about the Inquisition, as a romance, as a comedy, and especially as a mystery. And I think it's overlooked, and that's the reason I had it on here, tied with number 9 with another film that I think is overlooked as a mystery. And I love that it's directed by Jean-Jacques Annaud, because when we did our top 10 war films, you championed another Jean-Jacques Annaud film as being really tragically overlooked, and that was his war film Enemy at the Gates.
Yes.
And I think it's possible that Jean-Jacques Annaud, who also made, I think, the underappreciated Quest for Fire, I think he might be one of the most underappreciated filmmakers. Anyway, the four men who wrote Name of the Rose, it's a who's who of writers with such weird backgrounds. I love it. Gerard Brock, who wrote most of Polanski's masterpieces of suspense and tension, as well as the classics Jean de Florette and Manon of the Spring. You have Howard Franklin, on the other hand, who would go on to direct Bill Murray in a handful of films. So it's a bunch of different writers that are all bringing their own kind of flavor in adapting what, let's face it, was a book that was dense and had many, many layers to it.
Absolutely. By Umberto Eco, who was a massive read.
So
back in my college days.
So I have it tied with another adaptation that I think is underappreciated as a mystery, of a rather dense tome that was originally made as a mini-series. That's how dense it was. It's the 2011 espionage film Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. The first English-language film from Tomas Alfredson, who directed the movie we love, Let the Right One In. And it's based on Jean Le Carré's novel of the same name. How about a cast of this? Gary Oldman headlining as George Smiley, originally played by Alec Guinness in the fantastic miniseries. But Colin Firth, Tom Hardy, John Hurt, Toby Jones, Mark Strong, Benedict Cumberbatch, Ciarán Hinds. It's every great British actor of this generation. And it's about a mystery. It gets called an espionage film, and I think that hurt its box office here because we think that's going to mean action. But it was the number one box office film of the year in the UK, and it's because they have no problem following mysteries. We do now. If film noirs came out today, they would bomb because our audiences have a hard time listening. And that's what intelligence gathering was all about in the Cold War, was listening and observing. And this really is about a mystery of uncovering who the mole is. There are four suspects, and one of them is a mole at the top level of the British intelligence agency.
Exactly. In fact, this was the model for the reality series, The Mole, wasn't it? I mean, exactly. A real life situation where four celebrities in a room and you have to listen, and one of them's a mole.
Nominated for three Academy Awards, and a movie that I got to tell you gets more and more fun every single time I watch it.
Damn it. I got to rewatch that one.
All right.
I'm way behind.
What's your number 9, Dean Haglund?
You and all your ties. Well, my number 9, of course, I remember seeing this as a child. And when you talk about great casts and casting, here is a movie where Sir Laurence Olivier personally requested a young up-and-coming Michael Caine to star with him in a two-hander that had already been a big Tony Award-winning play called Sleuth. And it's a mystery film directed by Joseph Mankiewicz, of course, and a story about a crime writer who invites his wife's lover over for an evening of games, gameplay, and puzzles. And ultimately, the spoiler alert, it's all about to frame him as the robber so he could shoot him for revenge of being his wife's lover. Oh my gosh, it's multi-layered. It is edge of your seat. It is a mystery. And even at the end, it's fantastic. And it's why it's a staple in dinner theaters everywhere.
Which, there's no greater compliment.
Well, it means as a rock solid script.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Dean Haglund and Phil Lernes doing dinner theater sleuth.
Oh my God, that would be hilarious. Oh,
especially if we
set that up.
Especially if we can work in the Kevin Spacey bit from Soap Dish where we actually help serve the people. Like we're pouring coffee for them and stuff.
As we're saying, as doing the lines.
Yeah,
exactly.
Exactly. Staying in character and doing it. You know what's fun about you bringing that up is here we've been talking about how important it is to have all these ensembles, and it is, and all these suspects, and bringing them all together, and how do you handle them? And then, oh, by the way, here's a two-hander, and that can work
here's
too.
A two-hander. Yep. And it's amazing.
Yeah.
And you think, okay, it's going to run dry. And yet here's 2 hours of two great actors and beat after beat. Like if you are ever in question of what is a beat in a scene, like you often hear, okay, let's break it down into its beats. This movie has a rhythm that has each, and sometimes it's framed by the gameplay, but each arc that they go through in the 2 hours is so clearly defined that it's almost a lesson in what a beat looks like in a screenplay.
Well, there are so many great performances in mysteries, and bad mysteries or the kind of mysteries that I think a lot of people think of, which are all about the solution. Then you're in service to the plot and the clues, and I think a lot of actors feel hamstrung by that. But a great mystery, and the reason why great mysteries are the kind of film that I want to watch again and again and again, is that they are so conducive to multi-leveled performances because they are about secrets, and they remind actors of that which I think is true about most effective drama, which is it's about what's not being said, not what is being said. You know, you want to get to what is my character not saying and why is my character not saying it? And
right.
If you can keep deepening in that scene, okay, this scene, I'm not saying this and here's why I'm not. And then the next scene, now that I was not said, I have to address, here's what I'm still not saying. And so you keep deepening the levers, like peeling back the layers of the onion. And that's the performances that you're describing in Sleuth. They keep peeling back the onion.
Right. Absolutely. And so, wait, is this taking you to your number seven?
Well, no, number eight. My number eight is it's
number
taking
eight,
me to. And guess what, Dean? It's a two-way tie. And because I needed to have foreign language entries. So there's a two-way tie for my all-time favorite foreign language mystery films. And although the first one is far from being a two-hander, it does feature the two, I think, greatest stars of Japanese cinema. Two of the, certainly one of the most legendary. If there is a Rushmore of international actors, Toshirô Mifune is on that Rushmore. My favorite Japanese star of all time is Tetsuya Nakadai. And they star together in a great mystery that is actually, I think, my favorite film from perhaps the greatest filmmaker of all time, Akira Kurosawa. It's a movie called High and Low, and it's based on a 1959 novel by American detective fiction writer Ed McBain. And it's
Oh my gosh, McBain.
It's about a ransom. And, you know, when I was watching this again, Lily said, if I never see another child kidnapping movie ever again, it'll be too soon. And this is what's amazing. Maybe there were other movies that dealt with kidnappings, but people don't really remember them. All right. Modern kidnapping stories in movies, in television shows, they all trace back to the influence of this movie, High and Low. And it focuses on a wealthy executive in the shoe industry. He makes women's shoes, played by Toshiro Mifune, who's in a struggle to gain control of the national shoe company. And while he is struggling to do this, he has found a way to get enough control of the company through money. He's leveraged himself to the hilt, and he's about to buy controlling interest in the company when all of a sudden his son gets kidnapped. And the ransom, a record before that was a ransom of 2 million yen. The ransom is 30 million yen. This will absolutely bankrupt him. And then, and then they all discover that the kidnapper took the wrong kid. This guy's son is fine. He got the son of the chauffeur. And the kidnapper, realizing his mistake, says, it doesn't matter. If you let this kid die, your career is over because the publicity will be terrible. So it's still a 30 million yen ransom. And so so Mifune has to, Mifune's character has to decide whether or not he's going to basically bankrupt himself to save his chauffeur's son. Tetsuya Nakadai plays the chief inspector who is investigating and tracking down the kidnapper. The movie is, as you would expect from Kurosawa, it is stylistically so adventurous. It is two films, one a chamber piece shot mostly in profile set in the executive's home. And then the second one is out on the street, boots on the ground. You are there, noirish investigation trying to track the kidnapper down. Bridged by the most harrowing ransom payment sequence ever put on film. It's High and Low, and once the crime is solved, the real questions, the real mysteries begin.
Wow.
I have
that sounds awesome.
I have that tied with an even more mysterious film in a foreign language, a movie I know that you loved as well, Michael Haneke's Cachet. Also known as Hidden. And this is about a married couple who seem to be very happy, and they start getting videos delivered to them that show they are under surveillance. And this causes the main character, played by Danielle O'Toole, to start to explore his own past, his own childhood. It is a metaphor for both the treatment of immigrants and outsiders in French culture, and also about the historic whitewashing of an Algerian massacre that took place in Paris. All of this is referenced through turning the pages visually on this domestic mystery about this one couple being observed.
Yes, I love this movie so much. It's on my list. We'll talk about it later.
Okay.
I can't believe that's tied.
That's tied for number eight.
That's amazing.
What's your number eight, well, Dean Haglund?
My gosh. In terms of mystery, in terms of foreign language, and in terms of Mexican magical realism, there's nothing more enthralling to me than this movie. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but it has a lot of personal connections to me. It's a 2007 film by Carlos Regadas, and it's called Silent Light. And it's set in a Mennonite colony, which my mom was a Mennonite, of course, but this is a Mennonite colony in Mexico, in the Chihuahua state. And it's all in Low German, in Plätzdeutsch, which I grew up with. And it's a story of the community where a married man falls in love with another woman, and yet his wife then dies, But then does she come back to life, or is that just his guilt talking? And it is this deep, lots of long takes. I mean, your opening take is the sun rising in real time. And that's like 6-8 minutes of film of just watching the sunrise, and how the Mennonite community is its day-to-day life, and how these layers of mystery and existence and magical realism all come together so that you start actually questioning so much of just the existence of the film itself. It is really fantastic. And I think about it quite a bit, actually.
I have never seen this. I can't wait to see this. This idea of the long take is so critical to many mysteries, the one we just discussed, Caché. It's the long takes. And, you know, so many filmmakers here, and I think largely it is a response to our culture, they think that to create tension, you have to make the film faster and faster and faster. And really, right. A lot of tension is created by pushing off against that. The tension of being able to see everything and not really knowing, well, where am I supposed to be directing my attention? Which, of course, is the point of view of someone investigating a mystery. You have to keep your eyes and ears peeled at all times, everywhere. You never know what's important. And the tension of not having your attention directed for you can be almost unrelenting, as it is in movies like Caché, right? The long take builds the tension. And yet, I think... we talked about the Harvard MBAs who were running show business last week. I think they believe that, oh, well, that's too slow. People won't like that. It's too slow. And so
the attention span is gone.
So we need to keep the pacing up. So we have to edit it like it's action. And since we're editing it like it's action, let's make it action. And instead of making it mystery. That's fascinating. I can't wait to see that film. A director who is very good at the long take, obviously, and I was thinking about this question. Here's another mystery. Why was Robert Altman so gifted at mystery films? Think about it. I could have picked a mystery from almost every decade of his career and had it on this list. Like The Player from 1992 or Gosford Park in 2001. Yeah. Why was he so gifted at mystery? And a few of the reasons is because of that mastery of the long take, the floating, almost documentary, roaming style of direction, which allows you to go where you want to in terms of your attention, but it also puts the pressure on you because, oh my God, am I seeing what I need to be seeing? Am I getting the clues? Am I not, right? And he also, of course, was, if there was any director more gifted with an ensemble cast, I don't know who it was, maybe Cassavetes, but he loved ensemble casts. He was so gifted with them. And again, that is very helpful when it comes to mysteries, knowing how to balance your ensemble. And let's not forget, I mean, this is the guy that made MASH. He had a real flair for comedy. And it never hurts if you are able to both highlight and puncture sometimes that tension through comedy. So the film of his that I have on my list at number 7 is The Long Goodbye. And it's from 1973. It's based on Raymond Chandler's 1953 novel of the same title. The script was written by Lee Brackett, who co-wrote the screenplay for The Big Sleep in 1946, for crying out loud. That's how great she was. The film stars Elliot Gould as Philip Marlowe, which is kind of a funny inside joke in and of itself. But it's set in the 1970s. The story's period moved from 1949 to 1973. But the character of Marlowe remains almost an anachronism in terms of car and clothes and manner. And the point of it was to show that the idea of a detective hero by the 1970s was entirely anachronistic, that there was no place for them in our modern world. It is, therefore, right. a study of a moral and decent man cast adrift in a selfish, self-obsessed society where life, because it can be thrown away without a backward glance, has no meaning anymore, and where all notions of friendship and loyalty are utter jokes. So it is the most pronounced black comedy, and it is a wicked satire on all the illusions that Hollywood foisted upon us. It's a great film, and Elliot Gould's performance is one of my five favorite lead performances by any actor ever. The Long Goodbye.
Wow.
Number seven.
Fantastic. Well, my number seven, of course, I think you championed this. You turned me on to this, to rewatch it again with a fresh eye in terms of mystery. And this is the 1949 Orson Welles classic, The Third Man, with Joseph Cotten and Trevor Howard, and the story of post-war. How rare is a thriller, a mystery in post-war Vienna? You never see that set. And in terms of finding out who is Lime, his old friend, a suspicious death, of course, the threat on the Ferris wheel scene is a classic. Everybody who's seen this loves this. They know it. And it's and in the heart of it, it's a mystery that I'm not sure ever gets solved.
Well, it is, you said Orson Welles' masterpiece. Look, he just has a supporting role, and he's only in it for a little bit of time. He did not direct this. It's Carol Reed that directed it. But it sure right. seems like both the character of Harry Lime and the legacy of Orson Welles cast such shadows over it that it's easy to think of it as Orson Welles, the Third Man.
Right. That's true.
I like what you point out about Vienna. This is a fun thing about mysteries, especially when it's true of all movies. But boy, especially you're given free rein in a mystery film to make your location be a character. If you're not doing that, you're really missing out on one of the true opportunities, because you're allowed to do that in mysteries. I think you should do it in all movies,
right.
because our environment affects us in such profound ways. But Vienna, it was amazing, because this post-war Vienna city broken up into four, they were literally racing the clock to be able to capture it, because it was being rebuilt so fast all around them.
Right.
Based on a Graham Greene novel that he wrote in order to be able to write a screenplay. He only knew really novel writing was easier for him. So once they had decided to make the movie, he wrote the novel and then based the screenplay on his novel. And that's what took took some time. I'll be talking about it a little bit later on in the show.
Okay.
My number six, such an overlooked gem. And if you love mysteries, if you love Hollywood satires, you've got to see this film. Every last one of you in Chill Pack Nation need to see The Last of Sheila. Now,
what?
My question, do you know this movie, The Last of Sheila?
No.
Oh, God
no,
damn it, Dean. I'm sitting you down and showing you this movie. You will not believe this. Think of the greatest Hollywood satire mystery of all time. You might think The Player. You might think some other things. No, it's The Last of Sheila, for crying out loud. My question to consider as we go on in this show, what was up with the early to mid-1970s? Because not since the 1940s, the decade of film noir, was mystery the form of so many masterpieces. We've already mentioned a few. We'll mention more. But what was up with it? Anyway, The Last of Sheila, 1973 mystery thriller directed by Herbert Ross, who would be most famous for his Neil Simon adaptations and his musicals. It was written directly for the screen by good friends Anthony Perkins and Stephen Sondheim.
What?
Who used to host murder mystery parties, and they decided to make a game out of it using every story of inside dirt in Hollywood they could. It stars Richard Benjamin, Diane Cannon, who plays Sue Mengers, the great agent, James Coburn, Joan Hackett, James Mason, Ian McShane, and Raquel Welch, who believed that she was playing a parody version of another famous actress at the time, and Perkins and Sondheim didn't bother to tell her that she was really playing a parody version of herself, because everyone hated her so much. The It's wow. Here's the premise. On a one-week Mediterranean pleasure cruise aboard the yacht of movie producer Clinton Green, played by James Coburn, in a great performance, okay. The guests include all these show businesses personages who were all at his house 1 year earlier when his lady, Sheila Green, of course, Sheila, his lady, who was a gossip columnist, died under mysterious circumstances 1 year earlier.
Yeah.
And so everyone who was there is invited to a week aboard his yacht in the Mediterranean. And he introduces the concept of a parlor game because he's a huge parlor game enthusiast. And it's called the Sheila Green Memorial Gossip Game. And all six guests are each assigned an index card containing a secret, a pretend piece of gossip that must be kept hidden from the others. And the object of the game is to discover everybody else's secret while keeping your secret private. And each night, the yacht anchors at a different Mediterranean port city where one of the six secrets is disclosed to the entire group. The guests are given a clue, sent ashore to find proof of who that person is for that night. The game for the night ends when the actual holder of the subject discovers the proof and can destroy it. So you're assigned points on whether you get it right that particular night. So the game is being played when all of a sudden one of them actually turns up dead. That's the last of Sheila.
Wow. That sounds amazing. Was this in theaters? Was this a box office?
It was in theaters. It was not a hit. It was a bit of a sleeper, but it has a good cult following, and it's a huge influence on me, and I can't wait to show you this movie.
Fantastic. I'm dying to see it. What, you have it on
DVD? I have it on DVD.
Somewhere?
I have it on DVD, and I watch it all the time, and it gets better and better. It's one of my favorite Coburn performances, one of my favorite James Mason performances. Oh, he plays a director. There's so many great lines, but here I'll just hit you with this line. James Mason plays a movie director. He's on set doing a commercial, and he's talking on the phone to his wife, and the little girl who's starring in the commercial is sitting on his lap, and he says to his wife on the phone, because he has to get back to set, he says, darling, I have to go. My leading lady just peed on my lap, something Garbo never did, even at her moodiest. All right.
Okay, that's pretty funny.
What's your number six, Dean Haglund?
My number six. We switch gears, of course, now and come to a movie made in the year 2000, a thriller, but it's also, I loved that you take your timeline and chop it up. So many of these things unroll as the mystery that then gets you to the end, as it were. But here, the film by Christopher Nolan called Memento has a story of the lead guy, who's, I can't even think of his name at the moment, who's got antegrade amnesia and can only remember 15, 20 minute increments backwards. So he has to write on his body and take Polaroids and discover at the very end who is the murderer of his wife. Did I get that plot right? It's so confusing, actually. But I love this movie in terms of how it takes the linear narrative and literally flips it on its head. So clever, and actually deepens the mystery.
Well, of course it deepens the mystery. You know my weakness about this. I think it's perfectly done, and I don't give a rat's ass about it, because if you lay it out in linear fashion, there is no story. The whole thing is an exercise in the jigsaw, as opposed to the jigsaw structure, let's say, of Citizen Kane, where even if you lay it out linearly, it's fascinating. But there is not only no mystery, it's not even interesting in Memento. So it's a great early, I think he's learned his lesson by Inception, where even if you know what is happening, is it still fundamentally interesting?
Yes.
So that's why.
So I had Inception. Yes, I was going to do a two-way tie, but I thought you had too many ties. So
one can never have too many ties.
For Memento.
One can never have too many sport coats. One can never have too many ties. So Memento is number six. It's a perfectly constructed puzzle. I'm not much of a puzzle person, though. I really am not. You know, I'm much more interested in what the exploration of the mystery reveals. And that brings me to my number five. And this is going to be a fun one because we get to talk about the mysteries of David Lynch. And the beauty of limitations. Because I was thinking about how, and I think you to a lesser degree of enthusiasm, would probably agree with me on this point, that there's never been a director whose career more illustrates the importance of limitations on an artist, placed upon an artist, than David Lynch. You enjoy Eraserhead. Here's a movie that was made on a shoestring, right?
Yes.
Elephant Man is a good film, but it shows the danger. It's a very well done film with a powerful producer Mel Brooks working over David Lynch, but it also shows the warning signs of what happens when you let David Lynch's creativity go unchecked, because you end up with the Stargate sequence at the end of 2001: A Space Odyssey, right? In Elephant
right.
Man. Dune. Here's all the money in the world. Go adapt Dune. Or, in retrospect, please don't.
Please don't. Please wreck it.
But
yeah, exactly.
But that almost kills his career. So he scrapes together a low budget, has to make a mystery. It turns out to be Blue Velvet. It's terrific, right? Working on the limitations of television. The first season of Twin Peaks. So fascinating. But coming off the strength of the hit series, gets to make Wild at Heart. It's a colossal mess. So it's interesting how when he has to retrench, he so often retrenches to his strengths, which are no matter what your limitations are, you can always explore the mystery of something.
Yes.
And nowhere is that better exemplified than in his 2001 masterpiece, I think his greatest work, Mulholland Drive.
Mulholland Drive, no!
Here is a failed television pilot where he buys it back and uses his own money to turn it into a movie, and he by cutting one character out and interlocking all the characters' mysteries, creates something that makes perfect emotional sense when the solutions are revealed. But the mysteries all remain. It's often called a neo-noir mystery film, and I think certainly the references to noir are numerous. It creates careers for Naomi Watts and Laura Herring. It's the final film for screen legend Ann Miller. It has supporting turns, a great supporting turn from Justin Theroux and Robert Forster. Literally every character is engaged in investigating their own mysteries, and it, like I said, it is really a film that explores the beauty of limitations. And the heartache of dreams. I love that the tagline for the film that was come up with by Lynch himself to advertise it is Mulholland Drive, a love story in the city of dreams. That is so deceptively profound, that tagline. Mulholland Drive.
Well, you know my feelings to this movie. I've said it 1,000 times. And I'll give you that, yes, it is a mystery with emotional heart. Sorry, let me stop the leaf blower. The mystery, of course, is innate, but it is the mystery that he explores in all his work. Again, by throwing a bunch of red herrings, but that is just my opinion.
No, it's not red herring. It's Laura Elena Herring, and she was royalty. Two things. One, if Mulholland Drive as is was directed by me, you would call it my best work. you have a bit of a blind spot here. And two, this entire podcast is going to be the basis of a mystery because the last thing we heard before the door closed was, let me get rid of the leaf blower. And now people are going to do a blowout situation where they're blowing out the audio to hear whether or not, indeed, after that leaf blower does not report home tonight, if they can hear you kill him. All right, Dean, what is your...
The actual machine, not the leaf blower.
What is your number five, Dean?
My number five, we talked about before. We loved it. We saw it together. It's Caché. In terms of, as you said, the long shot, but also the need to see this on the big screen because so many elements are in the same frame that provide you information, including the final scene, which may or may not solve/answer the mystery.
Great point.
Or,
great point.
In fact, deepen it, you know? And so here's the, as it was known in film school, the democracy of the deep focus, wide frame shot that allowed you, the viewer, to not just find your own clues, but to come up with your own conclusions. I think Caché does that really well, and I think that's why a lot of people found it maybe a bit frustrating to watch, maybe a too quote-unquote European, as they say.
Well, it is interesting, this idea that long shots are the language of the big screen. Now, it's something very interesting that you're onto here where, look, if your attention is being directed for you, that plays very well on smaller screens. But to manipulate, but to use, exploit the canvas of the big screen and all it offers, giving the audience the opportunity to really explore it is unique to that medium. This,
absolutely.
The film won Best Director at Cannes, and it won 5 European Film Awards, including Best Picture. It made numerous lists of the best films of last decade, was controversially disqualified for the Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film, which resulted in having the rules changed because of the arcane rules that prevented it. You know, about... the filmmaker was from one country, it was set in a different country with a different language, and the money came from yet another country. Back then still, the Academy said, no, you've got to have the director and the language and the money all, match up. Which was ridiculous,
right?
Because international cooperation... It was what was required to get these films made. So, a great film and one that I would love to see on the big screen again. I remember the day I made you go and see that on the big screen. I think it was at the Fairfax, which is no longer there, but Cineplex Odeon in Fairfax. Remember, it was a bit of a discount house back then over by CBS?
Yeah. Was it there or was it the New Beverly? No, I think it was the Fairfax.
Yeah. Okay.
There you go.
So my number four, you already mentioned it, but my question, why is The Usual Suspects the greatest Kevin Spacey performance, and why is it one of Bryan Singer? Why is it Bryan Singer's one great film? And I will suggest, Dean Hagland, that there was something about a convoluted story involving people or a central character constantly staying one step ahead by creating a new character to play, by lying about who they are and creating wall after wall after wall to distance everyone around them from who they really are. There is something about that premise that we can now safely say speaks to the real world experience of both Bryan Singer and Kevin Spacey.
Wow. So that gave them the deep psychological, emotional resonance to bring it forward onto the screen.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Of course, the title.
We are.
The title, The Usual Suspects, it comes from one of Claude Rains' most memorable lines in the classic film Casablanca. But isn't it interesting that in that film, the lie is revelatory of the true nature of that character and those characters, right? The lie reveals where they morally are centered. And the movie, The Usual Suspects, keeps moving you further and further and further from any moral center, almost to reveal there is no such thing as a moral center. It was shown out of competition at the 95 Cannes Film Festival and then initially released only to a few theaters, which was the plan. It was a $6 million budget, but it received favorable reviews and was eventually given a wider release. And it was nominated for a few Academy Awards. Spacey wins for Best Supporting Actor. And Christopher McQuarrie wins an Oscar for Best Original Screenplay. And recently, the Writers Guild of America ranked that screenplay as being the 35th greatest screenplay of all time. So, Usual Suspects is my number four. What is your number four, Dean Haglund?
Well, my number four is a film that I remember seeing late at night on television and just being gobsmacked by the fact that there's no solving the mystery. And this is the 1974 mystery directed, produced, written by Francis Ford Coppola, starring Gene Hackman. It's The Conversation, where they play CIA surveillance experts, and they're all bugging and listening to each other. Again, a movie all about listening, and ending with holy smokes, the most harrowing scene of personal deconstruction, literally destruction of his own apartment, and finding no solution to this thing. It was to me, so epic. It was such a fantastic film regarding surveillance and who's listening to us and what wiretaps do to us and do to the listener, and the psychological turmoil and toil that takes on all those who practice it.
Yeah, it's a masterpiece. It's maybe, I think, maybe Coppola's best, right? I mean, even better than that year's Godfather 2. I mean, it's hard to, you know. The man in the 70s made Godfather, Godfather 2, The Conversation. He had two films nominated for Best Picture the same year. And Apocalypse Now. And here's another one from the 70s. I don't actually consider it a mystery. I consider it a paranoia conspiracy tale.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because
you don't think you... Who's listening to him? Who's listening to who?
But is that really, or is anyone listening, and is that even a mystery? You know, again, it's this idea of exploring, trying to prove a conspiracy is not the same as trying to explore or solve a mystery. Because it's all about projecting outward your paranoia instead of actually observing. And that's why it leads further into the deconstruction and the trap of his mind.
Right. But he is perpetrating. So it's not a conspiracy if he indeed is creating it, you know.
Well, welcome to every conspiracy ever.
Well, I guess that's true. But
the person exposing it created it. Because it only lives as a conspiracy in your mind.
Well, that's a good point.
So I think it's interesting. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I'm right. It's just, to me, the movie ends up differently if he acknowledges there's a mystery and explores it as a mystery. Instead of,
Are you sure he doesn't, though?
Think he approaches it from the beginning, playing to what he perceives as his strengths, which are about surveillance and, and conspiracy and paranoia.
Hmm. okay, I'm going to rewatch it with that in mind. I don't think I'm buying that argument only because he is the set. So there's no...
Because what's the mystery? Because what is the mystery? What is the mystery that he's trying to solve?
The mystery is ultimately, if he is the listener, who's listening to the listener? That's not a conspiracy. That's a mystery because technically he
is... No, that is a conspiracy because you just had a huge assumption.
Which is that he is the guy who's the listener?
Or that there is someone listening to the listener. That there is someone. See, I don't think you can call it of a mystery if the mystery itself is assumed. You know?
But all mysteries are... No,
you've got a dead body on the floor. You've got tapes revealing that you were being surveilled. You have, you know... that's what I would say. I think if it's a product of his mind from the get-go... And to a degree, this is again why I don't have Memento in here. That is entirely a product of his mind.
Interesting.
This
I
one,
I don't know.
Yeah,
I'm not buying it.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, I think you're falling prey to what the movie is actually about. It's actually telling you, you don't have to look for mysteries where there aren't any. That's what the movie is saying. And if you do, way lies madness.
Oh, well, you know, I lived that for 10 years, didn't I?
All right. My number three, and by the way, to all our affiliates, we're going a little long this week.
Oh, as always.
As always on a top 10. Okay, my number three, although film noir finds its roots in German expressionistic cinema, of course, its origins in Hollywood as a genre are fairly well established by the 1941 releases of two films, Citizen Kane... And my number three, The Maltese Falcon.
Maltese Falcon.
Written and directed by John Huston in his directorial debut, right? Which he was allowed to do because of the script. It's based on Dashiell Hammett's 1929 novel of the same name. It's the third version in 6 years of this movie, of this book, to get made into a movie. This one finally starring... the right protagonist, Humphrey Bogart as Sam Spade, Mary Astor as the prototypical femme fatale client, a wonderful, colorful cast of supporting characters and suspects, including Peter Lorre and Sidney Greenstreet, making his film debut, which we've talked about before. How astounding is that performance? He was so nervous that he was shaking, so John Huston found a way to sit him down in every scene to calm him. And then once he sat down, John Huston found the visual style for those scenes, which was, my God, that guy sitting in a chair is powerful. He is going to anchor every one of these scenes. I won't even really describe the mystery, but the story basically follows a San Francisco private detective who is trying to solve the murder of his partner, who he hated, and but because that's the rule, you're no kind of detective if you don't solve your own partner's murder. So let that be a lesson for you, Dean Haglund. No matter how much you're angry at me for championing David Lynch, when I get murdered, I expect you to solve it.
Damn it.
He deals with nothing but unscrupulous adventurers, all of whom are competing to obtain a jewel-encrusted falcon statuette out of mythology. The film premiered in October of 1941 in New York City, was nominated for 3 Academy Awards, and is now hailed as, of course, a landmark. The Maltese Falcon, number three.
Okay. Awesome. My number three, of course, what greater mystery than a mysterious black ops lady? We're talking about the science fiction classic from 1968, I think it was, 2001, Space Odyssey.
Whoa! You just threw me a curve.
I threw you a curve, because there is a mystery that is metaphorically laid out as a giant black obelisk that is run through the history of man and continues to run, even in that, as you said, the final sequence, trippy final sequence that either deepens the mystery or spells it out to you, if depending how you interpret those final scenes. And that is my number. What are we at?
Number three. I'm going to have to weigh in on this because I love that you considered it a mystery. I never would have entertained it. But one of the reasons is because, as we talked about, I've had this on other lists that we've done on top 10 shows. And so I try to use these as an opportunity to talk about different films, right? Like, not.
I see. So you're saying I'm just pulling out old.
No, but I don't know. I mean, you may remember this, but I gave a discussion and a lecture about this film. And the older I get, the more I recognize that the symbol of the obelisk itself, its meaning is, you know, because people always want to know, what does it represent? The size and the shape and the color. What does it represent? What's the symbol represent? And that's always fun, playing that literary game of analyze the symbol. What I realized that Kubrick was getting at was that the obelisk itself represents mystery.
Right.
Not that it is a mystery, that it represents symbolically mystery, that the gateway to other dimensions within us,
and to creativity
and and our consciousness is through the exploration of mystery that opens us to other dimensions within ourselves. So it's a great, I think it's a great, I wish we could stop the show there, but we go to our top two. And my number two, a bit of masterpiece. Again, 1974. See, the early 70s, man. Another neo-noir mystery. This one directed by Roman Polanski from a screenplay by Robert Towne. I think the only Polanski film I can actually bring myself to watch anymore, because just the taste in my mouth about Polanski has driven me to the point where all the other movies are ruined. But this one, written by Robert Towne, starring Jack Nicholson and Faye Dunaway, inspired by the real-life California water wars, a series of disputes over Southern California water at the beginning of the 20th century.
Yes. China, how great is that?
Chinatown, produced by the great Robert Evans, who, while president of Paramount Pictures, independently produced it as a Paramount release. It was the director's last film in the U.S. This film gets everything right. I mean, the mystery is so great.
And this is my number two, by the way.
Oh, it is.
So we could talk about this.
So, I mean, the puzzle is perfect. The reveal and the clues, so brilliantly placed. The political commentary, the satire of Hollywood, again, of the assumptions that movies have inspired us to make. All of these things work so well, and it's a heartbreaking love story.
Heartbreaking love story. That's, to me, the great folding of the two. If you don't care about water resource management as a MacGuffin for your mystery, you will be entrenched with the love affair between Jack Nicholson. Or not love it, just the relationship between Jack Nicholson and why can't I think of her name?
Faye Dunaway.
Isa Laura Mars.
Faye Dunaway.
Oh, so good, right? And so fantastic. So I love this film. I watch it again and again. I even just stop for certain scenes. At the time, like you said, what was it in the 70s that made all these mysteries so great? And I think it was a time of Watergate, of suddenly distrust, of suddenly just being jaded. And here, Chinatown, at the end of it all, of all unraveling and the murder, and then is just blown away with, forget about it, Jake, it's just Chinatown.
Well, the nihilism. The nihilism of the time, which is exemplified in The Long Goodbye also, and The Last of Sheila. It's like the film noir was born out of the dark side of the 40s, coming out of the Depression and the patriotism of the war and the post-war urban explosion of opportunity, but the jaded side of all of that. And yet through that jaded world would march these icons, these tarnished angels, as Raymond Chandler called them, with moral centers to make those urban jungles all right, to make them safe, to wage that psychological battle on our behalf. By the 1970s, it's become so jaded that we're told that the concept of being those tarnished angels who are waging that battle on our behalf makes those people themselves buffoons.
Right.
And Roman Polanski has his wear a giant, basically clown nose throughout the movie when you think about the bandage that Nicholson wears. The messages of it are actually deceptively profound. Like one of the things you learned to do when you were a cop in Chinatown was as little as possible. That was your mantra, right. Do as little as possible. But you know what? There's really, in a world that's constantly shifting where it's hard to find moral center, there is real wisdom to the idea, when in doubt, do nothing. Because
that's
doing something that you are not certain of means you are less than likely to be all right with the unintended consequences of what you do. Because there are always unintended consequences. So the only way to be all right with those unintended consequences is if you are certain about what you are doing. Do as little as possible.
Exactly. That's pretty good.
That's how you survive emotionally and psychologically, not just physically. All right. My number one, I can't wait to find out what your number one is. My number one, already discussed. One of my five favorite films of all time. 2001 is one of my five favorite films of all time. We've mentioned Citizen Kane in this show, though it doesn't make this list. One of my five favorites. One of my five favorite films of all time. The 1949 British film noir directed by Sir Carol Reed, written by Carol Graham. Joseph Cotten in a deceptively brilliant leading man performance.
Yeah.
Featuring a supporting cast, not only Orson Welles in just a larger-than-life, indelible screen performance, but the beautiful Vali, the delicious Trevor Howard, one of the most underrated screen actors, Trevor Howard, who, of course, had made a name for himself in David Lean's Brief Encounter years before. So many wonderful character actors and faces. It's The Third Man. As you said, post-war Vienna. It centers on Holly Martins, an American pulp novelist who's given a job in Vienna by his friend Harry Lime. But when Holly arrives in Vienna, he gets news that Lime has been killed under somewhat suspicious circumstances. And as you do when you have a friend who has died, as we say, the code certainly embodied in those pulp novels that Holly himself would have written. The code is you solve your friend's death, especially when the authorities seem uninterested in doing so. So it's all about Joseph Cotten's character, Holly Martins, trying to find out the circumstances under which his old college friend, Harry Lime, was killed. The black and white cinematography that we associate with film noir, never more beautiful. It might be the most beautiful film ever shot.
In
a very
gorgeous,
dark sense, right? But the expressionistic cinematographer by Robert Krasker, the first film to shoot on location at night, that technique of watering down buildings and streets because the light would bounce. The Dutch angle camera technique, which has led more than one person to think maybe Orson Welles did direct it. along with the iconic theme music, the zither music, I could tell story after story after story about this, and I would love to when you all come over to my house to watch The Third Man. In 1990, not what's up with, The Last of Sheila.
Oh, that,
by the way, one of the inspirations for The Lady Killers is The Last of Sheila in terms of the title. I'll leave it at that. People think The Lady Killers is automatically a reference to the Alec Guinness film, even though it's spelled differently. But it's much more a reference to The Last of Sheila. I'll leave it at that.
Okay.
Anyway, The Third Man. In 1999, British Film Institute voted The Third Man as the single greatest British film of all time.
Oh, Totally.
In 2017, a poll of 150 actors, directors, writers, producers, and critics for Time Out magazine saw it ranked as the second best British film ever. So we're basically talking one of the two greatest British films of all time, The Third Man. It is so much fun. I'm putting it on and watching it as soon as we're done recording. What, Dean Haglund, is your number one mystery of all time?
My number one is a Korean classic from 2003, directed by Park Chan-wook. I've talked about this film so many times. It is my favorite. Old Boy. Here's your pitch. A guy's in prison for 15 years, suddenly released, and he has exactly 5 days to figure out why he was in prison for 15 years. And or by tormentors he never met. It is stylistically amazing. There is elements of digital graphic work that is so telling of a deep inner psychological breakdown and or stripped bare to what is the very essence of fear and torture. And it won the Grand Prix in 2004 at Cannes, and so fantastic. This is a movie I watch again and again, and somebody has my DVD copy of it, whom I lent it to, and I forgot who. So it's been a while since I've seen it. But that, my number one is Old Boy.
That's interesting. Somebody has my copy of Name of the Rose. I was trying to rewatch that before this, and I wish I knew who I loaned that to. Let me ask you this about, because I thought about this, and certainly, you know, this is one of those cases where, you know, we were talking about mysteries are used in so many different genres. They blend with so many genres. And I tried to focus on films that are predominantly mystery, like I was surprised at how much High and Low, for example, the Japanese film, was a mystery, because I remembered it as more of a police procedural. On the other hand, the 1967 In the Heat of the Night, which I love, which I watch so often with Sidney Poitier and Rod Steiger, I remembered that as more of a mystery. But when I watched it again, I realized, no, the mystery is perfunctory. It is how they explore the character and race relations and social issues through the police procedural elements. So it ends up not being, to me anymore, a mystery. It's a police procedural, those being distinct, right? So my question for you is Old Boy, would you characterize it as a mystery, or would you characterize it as an action film?
Well, see, there's action sequences in there that are stunning, right? The single fight scene in a roving back and forth in a hallway with a hammer, a single guy with a hammer taking on, what is it, 50 to 80 bad guys? Yeah, there's lots of action in there. But at the same time, the elements of escaping, coming out of a suitcase, seeing a giant ant on the subway, or grasshopper, whatever that creature was, all of these things take what you would think is an action film or an action thriller film to a realm of not just a mystery of why he was in there, but the mystery of his own state, one's own mental state when faced with trauma and faced with refinding oneself, regrounding oneself.
That's nice. So, that's nice. Yeah. I trust you on this. I haven't watched it since theaters. Cause I've never wanted to watch it on the small screen. And I do recall I was really affected by the mystery of it. I feel like people remember it for the big signature action sequences, just how memorable those sequences are, I think I would agree with you that it is more a mystery than it is an action film. It's just how indelible those sequences are that people tend to think of it as those sequences. I would love to know whether the director of this film was a fan of The Prisoner. Because I remember when I watched it thinking that it reminded me a lot of The Prisoner. You wake up and you're in this prison and you don't know why or who put you there. And then you wake up and you're not in it. and you don't know why you're not in it. And, you know,
right.
And The Prisoner.
Which is the worst prison.
The Prisoner, of course, was all about those themes. And it was science fiction. It was spy. He was a spy character. But it fundamentally reveals itself to be about the mysteries that it's exploring. It's a mystery show, right? And so I think exactly like that is Old Boy. And again, I don't know if he was a fan of it or not. I would bet he was. And I think it's one of the great adaptations of The Prisoner.
Yeah, and fascinating. Well, that would require a sit down with Park Wynn-chuk to see if that is the case. Maybe at the next Q&A that we'll bring that up.
All right, we'll just guess it. Have him guess on the show. All right, that brings us to an end of more than an 80-minute long installment all about the great mystery films that we love. We'll follow up next week with some titles that didn't make our list and why they didn't, and hopefully maybe some comments and feedback from all of you. Write us chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. You know how to find us. Until next week.
Yes, we're everywhere.
I'm Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Haglund.
Belated spoiler alert.